Faith and Worry was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 1st, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I am calling this Some Rather Random Thoughts, with an emphasis on random, Some Rather Random Thoughts on Worry and the Lack of Faith. I want to talk about that a little bit, since I've had a lot of experience with that recently. This all started, my thinking was provoked by a conference that I went to with two other men. And one of the speakers at the conference was a rather young man, young evangelical scholar who is an Islamic scholar. And we had a whole afternoon with him. He was primarily focused on radical Islam and giving us a sense of the theology and the beliefs and the history of radical Islam, and it was very informative, very interesting. But when one comes to understand radical Islam, it gets kind of scary. And the reason it gets scary is because you don't see any solution. That the perspective of radical Islam is that they have a religious obligation. It is their moral due and religious obligation before God to take over the world, essentially, to go into a land and Islamize, make Muslim the people in that land. There is a word for it. That's not the word for it. Before I go any further, some of you are going to ask me, what was the name of the scholar? And you're going to ask me a lot of details. And I have a story I'm going to tell in a minute, but I don't remember any of the facts. Sorry. But what gets scary is that there's really no solution. As a Christian, I have a moral obligation to honor the God who is there, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Jesus. I mean, I don't have a choice about that. That's the truth, and I need to bow my knee to the truth, on the one hand. On the other hand, radical Islam insists that you believe what Muslims believe, and there's no alternative. As radical Islam sees it, following the hadith and the sayings and practices of Muhammad himself, their belief is that you go to a people, you ride up with your cavalry to a people, and you offer them to become Muslim before you attack, and if they don't become Muslim, you kill them. That's jihad. And it's not that they hate you. I mean, that's the thing that was so bizarre in listening to this thing. In the secular world, they're asking the question, why do they hate us? They don't hate you. They just have a religious obligation to kill you. It's not about hate. It's about faithfulness. It's about loyalty. It's about them honoring Allah. It's about being faithful to Islam. But the problem is, how do you deal with that? How do you compromise with that? How do you respond to that? How do you handle that? How would you stop that? So as you can imagine, as the afternoon went on, it was getting kind of scary. The more you heard, the more scared you were tempted to be. One of the things he did is he gave us the history of the various mullahs and Islamic thinkers, writers, who have contributed to the theology of radical Islam. And most of the important ones were actually educated in the United States. And at one point along the line, this young scholar mentioned this one individual whose name I can't remember. I mean, it's Arabic anyway, so. But he mentioned this individual who'd gone to the University of Colorado. And I wish I could imitate, I wish I was an actor, I wish I could imitate his tone, because there was so much that was communicated in his tone. And I have done a comparable thing probably dozens of times in my life. But he basically was scolding the church, scolding us, scolding evangelical culture, because he said, imagine how the world would be different if some evangelical Christians, while he was at the University of Colorado, had reached out to him. And, I mean, you understand his point. This guy has written prolifically propounding radical Islam, and he's the one that is most quoted by radical Islamic people today in support of their understanding of their faith. I mean, this guy has been highly influential. So his point was, what if he had become a Christian? You know, instead of being radicalized, he had become a Christian while he was at the University of Colorado. Just think how much this movement would have been defanged, diffused, undercut by if we had done that. Well, we get to the end of the day, and one of the men with me, he had laid out five things that he thought we as evangelicals needed to do in response to the threat of radical Islam, and they were good suggestions, and it was I have no problem with what he said. But one of the men with me said, could I suggest a sixth? Because I've been getting a little anxious and a little frightened, a little scared by your presentation this afternoon. Could I suggest that we remember the sovereignty of God? That's the only way I can respond to what you've been saying here today is to remind myself that God is sovereign and this is not out of his control. And immediately the scholar said, oh yes, absolutely. Yes, we need to remember the sovereignty of God. Now, why am I telling you this? It was so striking to me at that minute, the disconnect between his confession of the sovereignty of God, his acknowledgement of the doctrine and the theological concept, the theological idea that God is sovereign on the one hand, and everything that had underlay his presentation for the last several hours. There was a complete disconnect between them because if you really believed in the sovereignty of God, would you scold the church for today being today because you didn't do your job right? I remember being back in college where it was sort of really fashionable to chastise the Christian church in Germany for letting Hitler rise to power, for example. It was very fashionable. And I'm sure I did it probably several times. And, you know, wag my finger and scold us evangelicals because if we as a church had been faithful in Germany, Hitler wouldn't have come to power. Well, the more I realize who God is and what he's doing and how he's running history and how he's running the universe, what an absurd idea. Of course Hitler was going to come to power. That was right in script. It was part of what God was going to accomplish. It's part of what God was going to do in the world with respect to his people, the Jews, with respect to us as Gentiles. Whatever he was going to accomplish, he was going to accomplish it. Which is not to say, you understand, it's not to say that there's not things that we should be scolded about. Have we been remiss? Have we been responsible? Well, of course, yes. But it's not as if history was going to be any different if we had only done something else, if we had only done something differently. I got this mental image when I was thinking about this of, imagine these two little 8-year-old boys standing on the beach down in Thailand when the tsunami happened a few years ago. And the wave is coming at them, and one is saying to the other, hurry, Joy, help. If we don't stop it, people are going to die. I mean, that's how inexorable God's sovereign purposes in history are. It's like a tsunami coming at you. What are you going to do, hold out your hands and stop it? It's not like we can do anything to change the future, and that's not our goal. That's not our job. That's not our responsibility, any more than two little boys on the beach. Of course we can't stop the tsunami, and no one is asking us to. God is not asking us to. The point I'm making with respect to this young scholar, and I'm not pointing my finger at him. I don't know what he really believes. When push comes to shove, ultimately, maybe he really does believe in the sovereignty of God. I know how oftentimes when you get in the rhetorical moment of a lecture or preaching or speaking, sometimes you flip into habits that you yourself are not consistent with what you yourself believe. So I'm not judging where he's at. I have no idea. But it just pointed out to me the importance of recognizing that there's a difference, a very crucial distinction to make. To know that you should believe something is different from actually believing it. They're not the same thing. And yet we often confuse that. We are often satisfied in knowing what someone believes by asking him the question, do you believe X? Do you believe in the sovereignty of God? Do you believe in grace? Do you believe in whatever? We ask them, do you believe it? And they answer, well, yes, of course. Does that settle the issue? Not from a biblical perspective. Because what you're really answering is, well, I know I'm supposed to believe that. I know that's what the Bible teaches. I know that's what the apostles said. I know that's what Jesus said. That's what we're really answering. But the crucial question is not, do we know that a person is supposed to believe it? The crucial question is, do you actually believe it? And how do you know if you actually believe it? Well, that's where James helps us. Faith without works is dead. If you don't act like you believe it, then you don't really believe it, actually. And what this incident pointed out to me is part of the works that show that our faith is alive and real is not merely what we do, although of course that's crucial, but also what we think and what we say. What we think, what we say, and what we do, all that combined is going to either betray us as not actually believing what we should believe or as revealing and manifest the fact that we really do believe it. Okay, so what does it mean then to actually believe in the sovereign control of God over history? That's one of the things we worry about. I will get to worrying here in a second. That's one of the things that we worry about is the future, just the future of our civilization. We shouldn't, if we believe in the sovereign control of God over history, we won't always be trying to muster the church today to change the tide of history. It is very common, it is very habitual for us as Christian leaders to do that. There's something very seductive and tempting about that if you're a speaker. I think it ultimately is a form of self-righteousness. I'm getting the chance to tell you what we should be doing, so that makes me better than you. I mean, I know in the past that's been my motivation, is just flat-out self-righteousness. We need to not fall prey to that temptation. Our calling as Christians is not to transform history for Jesus. I think it's crucial that we understand that. That's I think, one of the youthful lusts that Paul tells Timothy he needs to flee. That oftentimes we read that and think that he's talking about sexuality, but even though sexuality probably is one of the youthful lusts, it's not the one that Paul had in mind there. It's competitiveness. It's the deal. It's the desire to vanquish in intellectual combat. And along with that, I think it's this idea, this hubris that God has called me to go to work on his behalf to transform history. That's my job. We are to flee youthful lusts, and that's one of the youthful lusts that we need to flee. God is quite capable of handling history and the future on his own. He doesn't need our help. He's not even asking for our help. What God wants from us is faithfulness. What God wants from us is for us to work out our own salvation, not the salvation of American civilization. He wants us to work out our own salvation. He wants us to be faithful to what we've been called to do, not to have an impact. There's another one that you hear often in evangelical circles, an appeal for you to go out and have an impact. It sounds wonderful. It sounds appealing. It sounds right. It sounds plausible. It sounds like, of course, that's what Jesus wants. He wants his disciples to go out and have an impact. I don't think that's right, though. It's very diabolically wrong. My goal is not to have an impact. My goal is just to be faithful, to work out my salvation, to run the race, to fight the fight for my own soul. When I understand the true nature of my calling, then, to be faithful, not to have an impact, then it's no longer a threat to me that the tide of history is unstoppable. I no longer need to be threatened by that. It drives me crazy when I think that me, along with you, need to turn history, change the tide of history. And when we realize how inexorable it is, it could be crazy-making to think about the possibility of doing that impossible task. Well, my friend who reminded the speaker of the sovereignty of God, how does it help quell our fears? It depends on what we're afraid of. If we're afraid of tragedy, and if we're afraid of failure, if we're afraid of disappointment and loss in our life, then believing in the sovereignty of God doesn't bring us much comfort. Because God has never promised us that he will protect us and make us immune from such things. And all of us who have read the Bible recognize that. We recognize that God can bring any number of trials and tribulations, tragedies, any number of harms into our life that are not fun and are not not something that we would choose for ourselves. So if that's what we're afraid of, then God's sovereignty is no comfort. But if we're afraid that God's purposes and his ultimately good plans for this world and for us as individuals may not come to pass, then belief in the sovereignty of God quells that fear completely. Because we can know, because God is sovereign, God's will be done. Nothing can thwart it. Nothing can stop it. His plan and purpose for our life is going to be accomplished. Now, it's that distinction, what we're afraid of, that really sorts us out as people. The child of God is the one whose ultimate desire, and I'm emphasizing the word ultimate, the child of God is the one whose ultimate desire is that God's will be done. Even when we're faced with the possibility that God's will may bring tragedy into my life and disappointment into my life and loss into my life, even though that may happen, I can nonetheless say, but God, I want what you want in my life to happen. That's what it means to be a child of God. I think sometimes we lose sight of that. But this is no option. This is not just a better way to live as a Christian. It's not just a strategy for coping better with life. It's not an option. It's what defines us as a child of God, one of the things that defines us as a child of God. If we cannot and will not bow our knee to the will of God, then we are not believers. We don't belong to him. The child of God trusts ultimately in the wisdom and goodness of God, such that ultimately, whatever God wants, I want. That's the attitude of the child of God. Forgive my language here, but as Jesus put it, not my will, but thine be done. Yours, in case you're curious. Not my will, but your will be done. That's the ultimate expression, the ultimate manifestation of a heart that belongs to God. The child of the devil is one whose ultimate desire is that his will be done. One version of that is my unwillingness to experience anything tragic or anything sorrowful or anything painful. If I am just completely unwilling to allow that and to accept that, then it betrays a heart that does not belong to God. And the sovereignty of God, of course, is no comfort to a child of the devil. It's of great comfort to the child of God, but it's of no comfort to a child of the devil because there are not the right kind of guarantees in the sovereignty of God. Okay, we can discuss that more if you want to. Let me make a rather awkward transition now to talk about worry a little bit more directly. I want to make a distinction between fear and worry. I think it's an important distinction. Fear is very natural and right and appropriate. I think God built us, made us, constructed us to respond in fear to that which is fearful, to that which is threatening, to that which is dangerous. So just because we experience fear is no indication that we have any sort of spiritual problem or that we're not believing or we don't have faith or trust or something. Fear is natural and right. But fear is in response to what is a real, actual threat. Worry, I would argue, at its essence, is fear of an imagined threat. Not a real and actual threat, but it's a response to an imagined threat. Worry is more often about what harm I can imagine coming to me. It's not a rational fear of a threat that I actually know is imminent. I think I've told you this story before, but this really came home to me once when all of my worry stories are going to be around my children. We were here in Eugene, and Morgan and Shelby were looking for a soccer match in Portland that they wanted to go see. And they called me on the cell phone, and they were lost. You know, looking back on the situation from this distance, I mean, people get lost all the time. People get lost in Portland all the time. It's not that big a deal. But my imagination went wild in response to their circumstances. They were there, I was here, it was an impossible distance between us for me to help them. All of my parental instincts to protect them came, you know, raging out, pouring out. And that in conjunction with imagination that was just sure they were going to get carjacked. I mean, there had been a rash of carjackings in Portland. I mean, there's just absolutely no reason in the world for me to have any realistic concern that there was really an imminent threat. But all of my emotions were as if the carjacker was right that instant breaking into their car. And I just panicked. It was just awful. It was another time where we were at a family thing and Morgan was driving off one direction and Jody and I were driving off the other direction. And we said, why don't you call when you get there so that we know you're safe? And the dingbat forgot to call. And your imagination just goes wild. Why didn't she call? Well, the most logical explanation is she forgot, Jack. But that was the least compelling to me. She was on the side of the road. She had a flat tire. She'd been kidnapped. Any number, I mean, your imagination just goes crazy with all the things that probably could have happened. And my emotions are responding to what my imagination said happened, not responding to what actually happened. That's, I think, what worry is, when the fear response is in response to what we imagine is the case, not what in fact is really the case or what my reason tells me is likely to be the case. That was the situation with Peter walking on water. If I read that rightly, and I've taught that here before, but while many people read that account that he was walking on the water and then he lost faith and began to sink in the water, I don't think that's right. He didn't begin to sink. He was being buoyed up by the power of God just as much when he lost faith as when he had faith. God was not drowning him. But the wind was whipping up, the waves were getting higher, and the waves came splashing up over his legs and shin and waist and something like that, and it freaked him. Not because he was actually sinking, but because he could imagine himself sinking. He could imagine himself drowning. And so he reaches out to Jesus, "Save me." Well, that kind of fear, that kind of cowardice, to be afraid when there's no reason to be afraid, is ultimately wrong, and that's what I want to highlight here. Sometimes worry is often fear of a harm that I imagine to be awful, perhaps even unbearable, when in fact the harm is not as bad as I imagine it to be. I may have told you this story before too, but this was a very dramatic experience for me. I don't know if you know or not, but we have four children living, but our oldest child choked to death when he was 2 years old. But before he died, my wife and I lived in San Jose, and I was working in Palo Alto at a church. And back in those days, it would not be unusual for me to, after the class, to sit around answer questions and have conversations with people till 1:30, 2, 2:30 in the morning. And then I'd be driving home down the Bayshore Freeway in mid-morning. And not many cars, dark, quiet, everybody's asleep. And there's something about that that stimulates fears and imagination. I can remember driving along thinking, I wonder if Jody and John David are okay, and began to imagine that the house had burned down and they died in the house fire, or any number of terrible things. And the pain of the grief that I imagined, the imagined pain of the imagined grief, was so excruciating that I literally had to turn my mind off. I couldn't take it. I couldn't stand it. It was very interesting to me later when my son actually did die. It was a very, very sorrowful event, very tragic event in my life that I miss him dearly to this day. But it wasn't unbearable. It hurt, but it was not a hurt that I could not endure. But as I imagined it before losing my son, I imagined it as utterly unendurable. I can't bear it. That would be the worst thing in the world. I think that's one of the things that makes the argument from evil against the existence of God so compelling to people, because it's an argument from the imagination. It's not an argument from reality. All you have to do is paint a picture of all these awful, horrendous things happening in the world, and there are a lot of awful, horrendous things happening in the world. But we imagine them being unbearable, unbearably crushing on the people who experience them. Well, God knows whether or not they're unbearably crushing or not. God, who controls all things and causes all things and is the author of all things, he knows what he's doing. They can endure, they can bear, they can make it, they can get their life changed, they can get their priorities sorted out in the light of what God is doing in their life. And yet we imagine it as being so unbearable and so crushing that we would dare wag the finger at God and say, God, how dare you be that cruel and that mean and that unloving toward my fellow human beings? Well, how unloving is he being? Actually, I'm only imagining how unloving he's being. I'm not living in the shoes of the people who are going through the trials and tribulations that they're going through. You've gone through trials and tribulations. It hurts. It's very painful. But was it unbearable? Or was God's grace there with you, buoying you up, helping you to endure, helping you to learn, and etching wisdom onto your heart in the midst of it? I think that's another example in the New Testament, when Jesus is on a boat, asleep on the boat, and a storm comes up on the Sea of Galilee and it begins to swamp the boat, and the disciples totally freak out and they come and say, Lord, save us. And Jesus rebukes them says, oh, you of little faith. I think that's what he was rebuking them for, is that they're coming to him saying, we're going to drown. And Jesus is saying to them, yeah, you could. It's not the end of the world. And it sounds silly. It sounds trite. But I really think that's his perspective. So you drown. And then you go to be with God in eternity, and your life begins. And God said this is the time that you make the transition from this age to the age to come. Is that the awfulest thing in the world? You're acting like it's the awfulest thing in the world, because your imagination is racing. Your imagination is going wild. You're imagining that there could be no greater tragedy happen to you than that you drown in the Sea of Galilee. He says to people explicitly at one point, don't fear the one who can kill you, and after he's killed you, he has nothing else he can do. The one to fear is the one who has the authority to cast your soul into hell. That's the one to fear. The worst tragedy is if you lose your soul, not if you lose your life. So the littleness of their faith was their lack of perspective, their having lost sight of what really is important and valuable and what isn't important as that and as valuable. And that's the damnable thing about our imagination, is my imagination can imagine different priorities, can imagine different values, can imagine different levels of grief and pain than have to be actual. And thus we worry. All too often, our irrational exaggerated fears result in an irrational desire to control a situation that I can't possibly control. And that in turn inevitably leads to panic because I'm trying to control what can't possibly be controlled. Just the latest example, my daughter Shelby moved to Rhode Island, and she coaches in Massachusetts, and she was coming home late at night, really late at night, and her tailpipe fell off the bottom of her car, and she didn't even know cars had a tailpipe. So she didn't know what to do. And we end up with this situation where the only help is this tow truck driver who's going to tow the car to his garage and weld it for her and fix it for her. Well, you can imagine what I'm thinking. Right. A tow truck driver who's, this is psycho. This is Bates. This is the Bates Motel that we're talking about here. It's one thing to want to be smart and to want to be wise, and I think we did some things to try to protect her that were probably wise, but the incredible temptation was to actually effectively and successfully take control of the situation when I couldn't possibly, from how many miles away, 3,000 miles away, couldn't possibly control the situation. The right response on my part would have been, God, you're not 3,000 miles away. It's in your hands. And to be able to believe that he had enough interest in protecting Shelby in the right sort of way, according to his will, that his will would be done and that I can leave it in his hands. It is so hard to do that because everything in me doesn't want his will to be done. I want my will to be done. Your will might be that we learn something, and I don't want that. And yet that's the fight that we have to fight. We have to look at that soberly and seriously and decide, what do we want? Do we want my will to be done? Or really, do I want God's will to be done, no matter what the cost, and no matter what that involves, no matter what that entails? That's a crucial question that we have to face and answer for ourselves. Now, let me be clear what I'm saying here. It's not the anxiety. It's not the stress. It's not the concern. It's not those terrible, awful feelings of fear that are symptoms of unbelief. Because that's going to be there anyway, in any sort of circumstance like I've been describing. What's unbelief is my desperate unwillingness to relinquish control of the situation to God. That's unbelief. That's what was so remarkable about Jesus' prayer at Gethsemane. You know, ultimately, not my will be done, but thine. You know, Father, if it's at all possible, I'm really actually not interested in your will being done, if it's at all possible to find a way for that not to be. But if that's not possible, then Father, your will be done, not mine. That's where we have to come to as children of God, to be the kind of people who ultimately so believe in the will of God that we are willing to relinquish control of the situation to God and let him act, let him work, let him do what he's going to do. I'm posing this as a option. I'm not confident here that I can sort out what unbelief would and would not look like, what that translates into our emotional experience. I don't have the wisdom to know that. But it does seem to be the case that when we give ourselves over to irrational, exaggerated fear, it's the result of some manifestation of evil within us, at work within us. Just our own moral depravity as sinful human beings, that sin goes to work and uses my imagination as a tool to work against my trusting my Creator. It's evil within me that's perverting the use of my imagination. Don't ask me how I stumbled across this, but in the Wisdom of Solomon, an apocryphal book, and I may not even have the translation right, but if I'm reading the Greek rightly, I would translate it something like this. Now, an act of cowardice is evil in oneself. Indeed, it, the evil, being always accompanied by the imagination, exaggerates the harms. In fact, fear is nothing but a betrayal of the helps that come from rational thinking. If I translated that right, and if that's true, that's what I'm saying. That evil within me uses the imagination to exaggerate the harms, and that's what I respond to. That's what makes my heart clutch, is when I am in looking eye to eye with exaggerated, with fears of exaggerated harm coming to me. And one of the antidotes, therefore, is being soberly rational about the situation. But the ultimate antidote is knowledge of and actual belief in the truth about God and his purposes. That whatever God's purposes entail, they are ultimately good, and I'm ultimately willing to embrace them. So I don't think the sort of worry that I'm talking about here is a trivial matter. It's not a problem that needs to be managed so that my life experience will be a little more comfortable. It is that, of course, but it's not merely that. Rather, unbridled worry of this sort, if it really is unchecked and unbridled, may ultimately be a serious spiritual problem. And that's why it's nothing to ignore. It's something that we need to confront and something we need to deal with. I was struck by Revelation chapter 21. Let me just read you a few verses here. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And he who sits on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. And he said, Write, for these words are faithful and true. Then he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But for the cowardly, and the Greek word that's used there is exactly the same word that Jesus used of the disciples in the boat when the boat was being swamped and they're afraid they were going to drown in the Sea of Galilee. But for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. It's just very odd and very curious that in this list of murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and liars and abominable people of all sorts and unbelieving of all sorts, he uses this word cowardly or fearful, or perhaps the English word would be craven, the people who are shamelessly fearful. Shamefully fearful. In that verse, he's taking that fear very, very seriously. It can reach a point, it can pass over a threshold, it can come to a certain quality where it's actually symptomatic of unbelief itself, of damnable unbelief, of the unbelief that leads to our destruction. So I don't have any wisdom as to when you know or how you tell when fear is natural and right and when it is unbelieving. But it's something that we need to consider. It's something we need to confront and something we need to think about, because if it's left unchecked, it's a very serious problem. We have 10 minutes for your comments or question.
Jack, I know that I sometimes have what you've been talking about is something that I've thought a lot about as well. And I know that I at times have a tendency to go a little too extreme and to become dispassionate about my relationships with people and what I care about and what I separate myself so much with the idea of, well, if this goes away, you know, that's what's God's will and I'll just let it go, that I become very guarded against that. Do you have any ideas of how to ward yourself against that sort of extreme?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's the Buddhist solution, as I understand it. That's the Stoic solution, detachment. Create a distance. If I can, if I can not be disappointed, then I don't have to feel the pangs of disappointment. So if I don't invest in anything, nothing can be taken away from me. That I don't think that's what we're being called to do as disciples of Jesus. We're actually dehumanizing ourselves, I think, when we do that. That living connected to people, loving people, valuing people is a right and appropriate and proper thing to do. What we need to do instead is be willing to go through the pain of disappointment rather than take it, adopt strategies to not be disappointed. Did that address your... So, that's a very important distinction. I think we don't want to steel ourselves against pain by not ever thinking of anything as important without by not loving anything. I think that's not the right strategy.
Carrier's privilege here. The first point you made about the nature of faith, am I right in saying the difference between religion and faith is the difference between submitting and embracing? An Islamist submits to God, a Pharisee submits to God, a right-wing Christian evangelical submits to God. The faithful embrace God.
Okay, that's good. I wasn't saying that, but I like that. Yeah, okay. That's good.
I have my moments.
Yeah.
And the second thing would be, it's a Gordian knot here about knowing when to do and when to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And this came home to me a couple of weeks ago. I had an opportunity to do some, I was out in the woods camping, teaching wilderness skills with a bunch of firearms instructors, most of whom claimed to be believers. And one man is a very gentle, kind, I think a real believer. He goes to church here in Eugene. And his dilemma was a woman in his church woke up, found an intruder in her house, and discovered she could not pray him away. His solution was buy her a gun and teach her to use it. And there's one of those, I see a merchant beaten by the side of the road. Am I the Good Samaritan, or did he get? Is he a drug dealer who got what he deserved? Is it my name? I mean, this is really tough. For different people, for different situations, how do we sort through that? How can we, when to know when to do and when to watch?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I'm not sure I have the wisdom to answer that. But let me just make one comment, and that is, faith is never contrary to rationality. I don't think it ever is. To pray instead of taking rational action to meet contingencies or real threats makes no sense. We are designed to be rational creatures, to do what is reasonable to meet our needs and protect ourselves and whatever. So whether it means buying a firearm or better locks, or I'm not sure which is the best expedient, but to take measures is not inappropriate. That a rational person would take. So the idea that I'm not going to protect myself, I'm just going to pray to God and have Him protect me or take care of myself or meet my need, that's not faith. That's some kind of carnival act that goes by the name of faith, but that's not biblical faith.
Is that indeed fear? Is that indeed failure to wrestle with our moral accountability?
Could be.
To respond properly to violence and evil?
Yeah, could be. Could be a form of denying reality.
I just wanted to say thanks. I think, speaking as a chronic irrational worrier, I think it's really easy to see yourself as a victim of the things that worry you. And I just really appreciate that you address it as a spiritual problem, because when I think about it, that's what it is.
Hmm.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This may be on a grand all of the world scale, what Logan was talking about with the one woman and the one intruder. But I think there's a tendency at times when we really try to wrap our minds around the sovereignty of God, we have to be careful that we don't drift into real stoicism. You know, there's a view that's sometimes expressed by people, well, it was God who raised up Hitler, so why resist Hitler? because ultimately it's God's plan. And once in a while I have to remind myself that the same sovereign God who brought Hitler, or allowed, whichever you want to do, Hitler to come to power in Germany, also raised up Winston Churchill and Dwight Eisenhower and a whole lot of people to resist him, and ultimately it was God's will that he be defeated. Mm-hmm. And I see that same thing going on now. You know, the kind of fear you said was created at that conference about radical Islam can lead to, wow, we just have to sit back and see what God's working out in radical Islam. But one of the things God may be working out is resisting radical Islam.
Yeah, that's well said, John. Yeah, exactly. The only comment I would add to that is I don't need to have a confident expectation of changing history in order to resist evil. Evil should be resisted anyway. So passivity is always wrong. Passivity in the face of evil is always wrong, because part of the fight for my soul, part of running the race and fighting the fight, is that I call good good and I call evil evil. I embrace good and I resist evil. And resisting evil is just part of my own salvation, I think. So I would do it even if it was hopeless that I could actually have an impact in history. And then if it's not hopeless, I have all the more reason to resist it. But passivity doesn't make any sense in light of what the Bible teaches. So thank you. That's a good reminder.
Jack, I'd like to work out a little bit with how you're thinking about rational and irrational fears. Mm-hmm. I really like the point that you're making, that we have a choice to make about whether or not we clamp down and control, or whether we open ourselves up to God being in charge. And that's a fearful thing, to know that God is in charge in the way that you've described, because it doesn't mean we're going to be comfortable. I wonder if, though, kind of having an irrational fear, kind of what I'm hearing you call an irrational fear, could be also connected with a real fear. And in that way, it's a way we can listen and learn and understand what it is we're really afraid of. And in that sense, we have an opportunity, maybe the same way like you would think about a temptation, that we can then decide, am I going to clamp down around this and try to control it, or am I going to explore it, discover what I'm afraid of, and decide to trust God with it? As opposed to calling, and I, certainly if I were fixed, no longer evil, completely finished, like I will be in the kingdom, maybe I wouldn't have that first response. I would just automatically trust God. But given that I'm not there, I need mercy for that. But I'm concerned a little bit about setting a bar that says, if I trust God enough, I won't have that experience anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I don't think that's realistic for any of us.
I didn't intend to say that.
Okay.
I mean, that's what I meant.
I wondered that.
That's what I meant by saying I don't have the wisdom to sort out when is my emotional mm-hmm. response rooted in unbelief and when is it natural and right.
Yeah.
I'm not presuming to draw that line for anybody, because I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think we need to sort that out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying there is a point where mm-hmm. we do cross a line where mm-hmm. I have given myself over to the irrationality of my beliefs in a way that I think is evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not telling you when that is.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I always want to clarify that our emotional responses are information first mm-hmm. and foremost, and not necessarily an indication of a moral condition or something like that.
This may not be a fair question, but could you flesh that out with an example? And
I could try. For example, I'll use your example of your fear about your children. Can I do that?
You can, but it was pretty irrational.
Right. Well, I've had those kind of fears about the people that I love, and I really understand the gripping of that. And so I'll even use an example in my own life when I imagined something desperately horrible was about to happen. In fact, for me, quite frankly, when I travel, I get really fearful when I leave, because all kinds of fears come up for me, because I think, I may never see the people I love again. Something bad might happen to them while I'm gone. Like, I can keep that from happening when I'm there. I mean, of course, that's really irrational on that level. But what I've learned to understand about myself, because I experience that, and I still experience it every time I travel, quite frankly, I kind of have to go through this process of recognizing, oh, there it is again. I'm really afraid. And for me, I understand a lot of where that comes from, and it comes from some really tragic early losses in my life that it just grips me. And so I have an opportunity again then to go, oh, it's that fear I have that I'm not in control. And I have to decide to trust God with it. And it doesn't necessarily mean I don't feel afraid. I might still feel afraid, typically the whole flight, but I am working with it and working at trusting God with it. And I think that's different than, say, if I saw that, felt that fear and, for example, just clamped down around it and decided to control everything around me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Where that's kind of the temptation, if you will, for us, that we want to control things, and that would be, you know, giving into that in a way. But that's not to say that we don't even do that. We might even clamp down and control things and then recognize that we do that and go, oh, there I am again, struggling to trust God and working with the fears that I have that come out of a context of the experiences that God has put in my life to sort through and to work with and to live with, okay, if you will. Is that good? Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you.
We may not have time for this, so stop if you need to. As Logan described the woman and the situation there, and pacifism was brought up, I'm a little bit confused, and I don't want to make a huge can of worms here, but I do want to ask, I guess I'm not convinced that if a person's response is more pacifistic, if that's a word, that is a sin as opposed to somebody that is going to fight. Maybe you're talking more about pacifism in general, and I guess I'm challenging that in our bent on our response on things, the way we are made, some of us might tend to be more one way than another. And I guess God's sovereignty, in my opinion, would rule over that, and not, it may be through pacifism, it may be through fighting, but his will be done either way. And I guess I'm not a pacifist.
I think you might be right about that.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm also curious, at some point I want to find out, because I haven't explored about pacifism and how maybe that's wrong. Time for that probably.
My gut reaction to that situation is, yeah, you should have a gun. But I don't own a gun. Well, I've got an airsoft gun, but it goes like that. So, I mean, I don't really believe, and there's nothing in me that really wants to defend myself in that way. So I guess that's what I really believe is. But I'm not against it in principle. It's just not me. I'm just not interested. So I think there may be individual differences there.
But it sounded like you were talking also a little bit more stronger language about pacifism in general, that it is a sin.
Well, no, the point I was trying to make is simply that it's not contrary to faith to rationally assess the threats and address them in whatever way I rationally would or should. And what you're adding to that is what I may decide is the rational way to address a threat may be different than what you may decide. And I think there very well may be individual differences there that have, I mean, the fact of the matter is, even if in principle, my number was up for Vietnam. I was too blind, so they didn't take me, but I was prepared to go as a non-combatant, not because I didn't believe, not because I was a pacifist in principle, but I just thought as an individual, I can't kill anybody. I mean, I won't be able to pull a trigger. So I don't mind going out and being a target, but I just don't, I'm just not personally wired to be able to kill somebody, so I don't want to carry a weapon. Well, I'm not making that decision for mankind. I'm just making that decision for myself. And that's where I think there could be some significant individual differences. One more. Jonathan had a question.
Hey.
Hi.
I really liked what you said today. And I think it's, a lot of good words. I don't know if we use that kind of Christian lingo around here, but good words today. There is, it seemed like one part of, you were really focusing on God's will today and God's sovereignty. And I think that is, utterly important. And someone raised a question of using that as a means to sort out whether or not to be an actor or whether or not to be a watcher. And that's as you know, it's like extremely complicated question.
Yeah.
Some of the other threads that you noted, but you didn't talk about necessarily today, is that it's not just God's abysmal will, like this God that could ask me to kill myself. You know, it's not this God who's not good and who's not wise, but it's as you notice, the reason why we submit to this will and why we love this, why we want this more than our own will be done, is because of its wisdom and goodness. Yet we also know that the vision of what is the good, as people maybe learn in Brian's class on Plato, that isn't across the board shared as to what that looks like. What is wisdom? That isn't across the board shared what that looks like. So I think there is a distinct vision for goodness and a distinct vision for wisdom that maybe can help us sort out when to be actors and when to be viewers.
Right.
And actually a little anecdote comes to mind, short one. An author was talking about one of his nephews in Texas who was like really into Roy Rogers. And it was like holiday season, they're reading from the Bible, this like passion narrative. And the kid just kind of blurts out finally, he just can't take it anymore. He's like, well, I would have shot those SOBs up. because it makes total sense. A good guy's going down, time to grab the guns and let's get that Jesus off the cross, And it's like, yeah, yes and no, because a person who had a vision for what God's goodness is and what God's wisdom is would have seen the utter profound necessity of what was going on. In a situation that the common sense knee-jerk reaction of an 8-year-old Texan, can't grasp. His sense of goodness and wisdom isn't refined enough to the particular Christian vision for what God's purposes are, which are very historic. They're very they have a form to it that's identifiable, I think.
Yeah, no, great.
Degree.
Thank you. Very, very good comments. Notice there was one Texan who used his sword to slice off an ear before Jesus says, wait. Okay, I've kept you over. Thanks.